G'day and welcome to another episode of Sacred Cinema with me, your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, here on 2XX 98.3 FM. This week's topic, Middle Eastern cinema with special guest, Sarah Barry. Yes, we're looking at a pretty broad area of cinema, or the history of cinema today. We're looking at films from the Middle East, a very expansive region of many nations through many generations. And we're joined by, we have a special guest with us, and that is an old university friend of mine, Sarah Barry. She's traveled throughout the region, studied it as well, worked in it as well. We're going to introduce her in just a second. It was a really enjoyable interview. She knew a lot more about the region than I do, so it's quite enlightening, not just in terms of the sort of cinematic techniques used by a lot of the directors in the films that we're going to be chatting about, but some of the, you know, the interesting socio-cultural background facts and that sort of thing. So always good to get someone else on the show, get a new perspective and that sort of thing. And in terms of some of the themes that sort of get lifted up in all these films, I think they do sort of link in with a lot of the movies we've talked about in recent weeks. I mean, personally, I do think a lot of them link in with this idea of not necessarily self-destruction, but being able to liberate, you know, the tension between liberating oneself via the means of, you know, this thin line between being sort of self-destructive or acting in a way that is constructive, but maybe just requires a great deal of endurance. It's an interesting line to walk, and we're going to walk it today with Sarah Barry. Well, hello, Sarah. Lovely to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us here on 2XX 98.3 FM on Sacred Cinema. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, it's great to catch up. We do know each other from university days back at the ANU, but you are now overseas, over in London. Can you tell us a bit about what you've been doing the last couple of years?
Yes, I left Australia just before the pandemic, which was, I guess, a bit lucky. And I've been working overseas in law, and I've just finished doing some master studies in law over in the UK, and now about to start a new job again in London.
Very exciting. And we're going to be chatting today specifically about Middle Eastern cinema, which is obviously a very broad and diverse topic. We can't go through the entire history of that, but this is something that you're particularly interested in, or at least have found yourself to be quite interested in. Can you talk to us about when this started and how it sort of relates to some of the stuff you've done in your career thus far?
Sure, definitely. I think just before I started university, I was like tossing up what I want to do, and when I worked out that I was particularly interested in the region, Middle Eastern. I did a Bachelor of Middle East and Central Asian Studies. And for me, I very quickly found that cinema was a good gateway into culture and languages. And I just found that quite fascinating. And since discovering some films, I've always found it's a good way to tap into learning languages or just picking up, just understanding different regions. Mm.
And you've done a fair bit of travel in the area as well. Can you tell us where you've been around the Middle East and that sort of thing?
Yes, definitely. I after falling in love with some Iranian films and just then kind of learning more about the history and culture and social political context, I spent a little bit of time in Iran, which was fantastic. I've worked in the UAE for a year. I've been to Israel, Palestine a few times. And where else have I gotten to? Oh, Qatar. I've been to different parts of the Middle East. So it was certainly interesting seeing some of the things I'd saw on films in real life.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely an area of the world I think like not many people have probably traveled to for various reasons. I actually met some guys that had just traveled through Iran when I was traveling through Vietnam. And they were telling us that of all the countries, they'd actually traveled from... They're from Germany, and they travel all the way from Germany all the way to the bottom of Vietnam. And I was talking about, well, you know, what country was the best one? Where would you recommend? They're like, the people in Iran are the most hospitable, most friendly. Does that resonate with you?
100%. Yeah, that's what everyone said. And you get there, and it was very much true. It was just one of the most beautiful countries in the world. I felt very safe there. Like, I traveled a bit with a group and then I traveled a bit alone and I had no issues. And it was just, everyone was, you know, very helpful, willing to help out. And yeah, just, it feels like, you know, everyone wants to make you feel at home there.
Mm-hmm. And then I suppose, like, even within a lot of the countries in the Middle East, be it Iran or any of the other ones that you might have traveled to, I would imagine that there is a fair bit of, like, diversity within those countries, and the countries themselves are obviously very different in terms of the cultures that are present there. It's like, I think maybe from my perspective, or from perspective of people that haven't traveled there, maybe have quite a generic view of sort of Middle Eastern culture, whatever that might even mean. Yeah. And in traveling there, did you sort of find that it was a very diverse area and, like, lots of different cultures and things like that throughout the region?
Oh, absolutely. Like, it really depends. Like, it is such, yeah, a large area and different, like, historical and even more modern influences, experiences of war. Like, for example, I spent a year working in Dubai, and that's in the Gulf. And it's actually, you know, not very far. It's just across the Gulf to Iran, but it's a completely different country, and for various reasons. So, you know, they might be geographically quite close, and then, you know, a few countries down, you've got Iraq too. So it is, and I think that's definitely something that attracted me, this region. It's just, very diverse. There's lots of culture, history, and even just food. I love that. That's also a good reason for traveling there. The food there is incredible.
Yeah. There's definitely a couple of good scenes of eating in some of the films we're going to talk about today. So the three ones that we've sort of got to focus on mostly are About Ellie, directed by Asghar Farhadi. We're then going to move on to Women Without Men, directed by Shirin Nishat and Shoja Azari. And then finishing off with Denis Villeneuve's 2010 film Incendies, which I think a lot of the listeners may have seen a couple of those ones. Incendies has actually been recommended by some of the listeners to Sacred Cinema that we chat about that one. So I'm quite excited to get stuck into that one. But why don't we start off now with About Ellie? So can you talk us through this one, Sarah? When did you first see this one, and sort of what sort of impact did this have on you, and what sort of aspects of it do you appreciate about this film?
Oh, I'm trying to remember the first time I saw it. I think I saw it after watching Asghar Farhadi's, I guess, more famous film, A Separation. Mm. And this one just precedes it, and it's got similar themes. It must have been, I probably would have been in high school still when I watched it. Mm. But I think one of the things that really resonated with me and all of Asghar Farhadi's cinema is the way he sometimes takes, I guess, what might seem, if you said, oh, Sarah, watch a film about the couple getting separated and the kid wants to decide which parent he wants to stay with, or Sarah, watch a movie about, you know, a group of couples going to the sea for a weekend and things don't go who seem. I might say that might sound a bit mundane, or like, what's really going to happen? Why am I going to want to watch it? And he's got this incredible ability of, I think, just teasing out small details and just making this tangled web. And so you're really, like, you're engrossed in what was otherwise just a simple weekend away at the beach of friends. And I think that's certainly something that really interested me about Ellie, is just the web of lies and how it builds up and builds up. It's almost thriller for what is otherwise quite a slow and non-dramatic, what would otherwise be a non-dramatic event.
Yeah, that's 100% the effect, or at least that it had on me. I mean, it's so interesting talking about a film like this when we're talking about it having sort of regional significance in terms of Iran and that area of the world. But this is so similar to me, or at least the start of this film is so similar to so many like French films about, like, going down to the French Riviera. We've talked about a couple of Eric Rohmer films on this show, which for all intents and purposes start exactly the same as this film. It's like a group of friends or a group of young people going down.
Yeah. Yeah, just screaming out the har and happy, and then all of a sudden it's just, slow derails from there.
And then things sort of, and I guess on paper, not really that much happens in this film. But of course, I suppose the pivotal event is that Ellie, the namesake of the film, does disappear, and they're by the seaside. There's questions about whether she's drowned or whether she just went home or she's hiding and that sort of thing. So there's a great deal of ambiguity in this film. Do you think that sort of speaks to some of the social relations that take place either in Iran itself historically or just amongst people in the modern world at all, the way that sort of we're not really sure where each other are and anything like that?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I'm not sure in terms of ambiguity, but I guess how much do we really know someone, I think, is definitely something that popped up. And I guess a strong theme or something I took away from this film is whose narrative do we believe? And, you know, someone can tell you one thing. And that was something that really resonated with me. It's like, oh, I don't actually know what version of events I believe, or actually who do we know the best and who's telling the truth. And I think that's certainly true for always.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because she, as a protagonist, is like, we don't really get to know her very quick, like very, you know, we don't get to know much about her at the beginning of the film. And then we're sort of trying to build her, who, you know, what she may have done, the kind of person she was, together with a very limited piece. And I suppose that's the same for the characters in the film. Do you think that there's an element of this movie which is like we fail to sort of dignify people in a way by not sort of getting to know who they are, and sort of it's very prejudicial about expectations about a person, and more so than that, you know, maybe in prejudging someone, sort of trying to make predictions about what they did, and sort of judging them for it without even knowing, you know, the actual truth behind that at all. I mean, I'm thinking about sort of when the I don't want to give too much away for viewers that haven't seen it, listeners haven't seen it, but when the gentleman joins the rest of the group who has prior relations with her, and we're very concerned about how he's going to view her, despite the fact that we don't even know what she did or why she did it and that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. No, definitely. And you know, there's obviously parts of the group that are keen to judge, and there are others who, I guess, and another theme is, I guess, protect honor, etc. And everyone kind of forms an opinion. On that note, I think one of the things that's quite interesting is, as much as it is about trying to unfold Ellie, one of the real protagonists is Sepida, who's the one who's brought her for the weekend, and she, you know, makes some questionable decisions, and we don't ever get an opportunity to find out more about her, to understand really actually why she's made these choices, I think that was something that I walked away with. I was like, oh, I really don't know how to feel about her. Was she good intentioned? You know, was she manipulative? That was one thing. If we found out about Ellie, and we're kind of like trying to judge her the whole time, but a lot of the time we're actually judging Sepida the most.
Yeah. I feel like she's in a very difficult situation as well, because I suppose she's very well intentioned from start to finish, in a sense. Like we do sympathize with her to a degree, but I suppose there's a lot of sort of entrenched norms within the context that she lives that means that she can't, you know, she can't stay away from some of the judgment that comes, and it sort of, I guess it does lift up this, you know, you mentioned before about it, like a network of characters, but there's almost like this network of right, you know, things that are right, network of things that are wrong, and having to sort of navigate this very complicated web of morals, like very rigid and sort of dogmatic morals, that sort of juxtapose what's otherwise a, you know, nice, pleasant seaside experience. Can you speak at all to like the sort of impending background? I don't know if it's necessarily an Iranian issue, but this sort of impending background behind all this, that, you know, it's got the illusion of being a nice trip away, but behind there's some pretty serious consequences, right, for doing what's, you know, supposedly the wrong thing in this context.
Yes, certainly. I guess I'll try and say what I can without, again, giving things away to your viewers who haven't seen the film, but yeah, certainly there are some serious consequences, I guess, for issues like looking after family, like honor and purity, etc., which I guess are still lingering themes for women, and marital relations. So there's definitely that against like the backdrop of, and you can kind of feel that kind of gnawing at you know, what's happening in the foreground. Has that been an issue? And definitely something that also I think was built up on this as well, just kind of like the bit more of the carefree nature of, I guess, the upper middle class Iranian society. And you see, like, they're wearing the hijab, but it's kind of very, very loose. They're a bit more carefree. They're having fun. They're not as religious. And just there's, I guess, that social commentary as well.
Okay. Can you speak a little bit more to that sort of that strata of society there? Is that sort of something that people are sort of particularly concerned with, or is it a sort of an outlier in society the way that, you know, there are these like a different strata there or that, you know?
Absolutely. There's different, like, it's such actually a huge country. I didn't actually realize it was until you're busing around and it takes like a whole day to get somewhere. But yeah, I mean, obviously since the 1979 revolution, it's a very Islamic country, and women have to be covered. There's no alcohol, for example. It's a very religious society. But that being said, there's different parts of each city, and some cities that are historically very, very conservative.
Yeah.
And then some which are a bit more, I guess, not as religious. They perhaps just wear religious items because they have to, not because they feel particularly religious at all. So definitely if you move around the country, even in parts of Tehran as well, then you'll see that there's real, and there's obviously sometimes internal conflict between, I guess, religiosity of people in the country.
Yeah. So I guess lifting up all those themes about, being required to abide by certain religious norms and things like that. You talked before about honor, yeah, purity, and then the big movement in, was it 1979? Was it the liberation movement from, you just mentioned a second ago?
Sorry, the 1979 was the coup when the Shah, who was, I guess, the more historical monarch, and who was a big friend of the US, he got overthrown by religious forces and Ayatollah Khomeini, and that's when Islam became like the Islamic Republic of Iran, and yeah, it was a big, you know, all of a sudden big change from being this kind of, I guess, more westernized Iran as it perhaps was known. You know, there was no, you didn't have to wear religious clothing, to all of a sudden it like went to now this quite what we know of Iran today as being an Islamic state.
So speaking of sort of those shifting political moments, I think it might work for us to move on now to Women Without Men, also from 2009. This is an interesting film, very different to About Ellie, which has sort of a very realist feel to it, where it's sort of very slice of life. There's a lot of, yes, sort of metaphorical aspects to a film like Women Without Men, a lot of deep sort of mythic symbolism and that sort of thing. Can you talk the listeners through what this one's about and what happens in this film?
Yeah, certainly. It really just does track the different lives of five women in Iran from different backgrounds, different experiences. And it's, I guess it's just all, each kind of, the, it's based on a novel, and they're kind of broken up into, yeah, I guess looking at the five different women, and each is a bit of different social commentary, and it's finding themselves all at the end in, I guess, this kind of garden, both, you know, physically and metaphorically, where they might feel liberated.
There's definitely some themes of liberation in there. And unfortunately, I think, you know, one of the means through which liberation is depicted, I don't mean unfortunately is a criticism of the film, but rather a criticism of, I suppose, human nature. But this sort of sense of, we talk a lot about on the show about this sort of dichotomy between self-destruction and sacrifice, and the idea of like a lot of time putting yourself through something and sort of silencing all of the, you know, the hectic nature of the surrounding world that sometimes culminates in like a very sort of self-destructive suicidal imagery, particularly in films. There's actually countless films we've talked about on the show that sort of have that sort of through line. Watching even both this and About Ellie obviously being about, you know, there's a massive element of drowning, which has this sort of quality of silence, you know, silence from the waves going down. I mean, even people who talk about transcendental meditation talk about the idea of going deep into water as an idea of like silence. There's a Terence Davies film that we actually talked about a couple of weeks ago, which is called The Deep Blue Sea, which also incorporates this idea of, you know, being, you know, brought, you know, finding liberation from all of the loudness and the volatility of life through sort of like suicidal imagery. And we see some of that in this film too. So I just thought it was interesting to make that comment, that I think a lot of films sort of very often have these through lines of liberation through a means of self-destruction or suicide. And obviously we have the running image throughout this film of one of the characters falling off of a building, and that sort of being this sort of unfortunate means of her liberation. Can you speak to sort of the sort of multifaceted quality of liberation, or how it's sort of this concept of liberation being conceived in sort of many, lots of different ways, and sort of a very multifaceted concept in this movie?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's quite interesting that you mentioned like liberation, because we also have not only the liberation of the women in it and what that means for them, if that's just escaping a family, or if it's escaping, you know, working in a brothel for one of them. But also we have not only the liberation of the individual characters, but in the background, one of the main things that the string that's pulling it all together is the radio commentary and images of what's going on politically in terms of liberation of Iran.
Yeah.
Because it falls against the backdrop of the 1958 coup d'etat, when the Shah, who was then overthrown in 1979, back when we were discussing about Ellie, was reinstated after the leader at the time was nationalizing the oil fields, which did not please the Brits or the Americans. And so it's, I guess, wildly believed that they insisted in facilitating the Shah overthrowing Mossadegh.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So there's that kind of liberation happening in the background. There's the individual liberations. There's various, I think it's quite interesting in this film how it's done.
Yeah, so you sort of got those parallels of the individual and the greater, the state, or, you know, this culture at large. And their liberation is through, I suppose, was it a violent period in their history, that change?
Yes, well, it's actually interesting. It's going almost in the opposite to what we see in the film, because I guess perhaps you might consider liberation as when the nationalization occurred, but what we're seeing in the film is the coup, which is then going to perhaps not liberate the nation from foreign influences, and being, I guess, you know, in the pockets of states like the US and America. But definitely a violent period, not in the sense that there was like a huge war, but in any kind of civil unrest. And when you've got different political factions, that's certainly a period of much unrest, but not gross violence.
No, not as destructive as other periods in history, maybe in other nations in the region. But as someone who has an interest in that whole area and seeing sort of the different depictions of that, particularly in this third and final film that we'll get onto in just a second, do you feel that there's this is a point of interest for a lot of Middle Eastern filmmakers to somehow conceive of, a future in a lot of these countries where there actually is a sense of peace? Because it does sort of seem, from an outsider's point of view, when we think about the Middle East, it is constantly characterized as an extremely violent and volatile region. And so it becomes this sort of centerpiece in a lot of these films. Do you think that this conception of the garden being this sort of nurturing, green and natural realm, is sort of almost like this idealistic vision, or it's sort of like this carrot that a lot of the characters or the societies being depicted are actually seeking? Is sort of the pursuit of peace, I guess what I'm saying, is the pursuit of peace sort of very central to not just the characters in the films, but the people of Iran specifically?
Yes, definitely. I think, everyone always strives for some form of peace, and there's definitely, obviously, unrest has been a big part of, I guess, the modern history of the region for various reasons. But I also think the garden imagery is quite interesting in the Women Without Men film, just because, I guess, of the, other cultural elements to Iran, in the sense that it's got a Sufi tradition, and that's what you kind of see, those mystic elements to the film. And traditionally, that's a strong connection with nature, and understand that nature has got these kind of almost mystic qualities. And there's certainly plenty of recent novels that tap into that. But I think there's also that element too, which you see this, the garden it's going to heal, or the women feel connected to it, and it brings them that peace.
So I think that might be a nice spot to actually move on to our third film. It'll be our last film we chat about today, and that's Incendies, directed by Denis Villeneuve, who people would know, you know, nowadays from things like Dune and Blade Runner and stuff like that. But this is one of his first films. Can you tell the listeners about this one, Sarah?
Yes, this one, it starts in French-speaking Canada, and it follows the story of a set of twins who have just discovered that they're, after their mother's died, she's given them given them an instructions to, so she can fulfill some promise that she couldn't make in her life, to find their brother and their father. And so through this, they return to, it's a fictitious country, but I guess it seems mostly based on modern day Lebanon and the experience of Lebanon during the Civil War of the 80s and the late 70s. And it tracks, I guess, both the children going back and finding, I guess, pieces and putting together the pieces of her mother's life, whilst also then flicking to the actual story of her mother at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess it sort of acts as like, it's interesting that it transcends, you know, a specific country, but it still resonates with us in terms of our understanding of what was happening in mm-hmm. Lebanon at the time. And then there's obviously, without, you know, this has got one of the great endings of modern cinema. I mean, a lot of people consider this one to be top echelon narrative mm-hmm. Storytelling. But there's definitely sort of like a self-destructive element to this film. Do you think that that's sort of an underpinning theme, at least in Lebanon itself, and definitely, you know, definitely some of the things we've chatted about already on today's show, but this sort of self-destructive nature to a lot of the politics in the societies depicted in this film?
I don't know if I describe it as self-destructive, but I guess it more broadly destructive elements of, I guess, the religious clashes, particularly in a country like Lebanon, where there's just so many different factions that it's almost impossible to have like a cohesive whole government running it, because there's so many different religious groups that are trying to, I guess, have influence and a strong role in the country. And so I think that does become destructive in its sense, in itself.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, the idea of this, like telling the story through a familial lens, you know, the relationship between siblings and parents and brothers and that sort of thing, it does lift up this idea of connectivity and brotherhood, sisterhood in the region, which is so tragically, you know, so often tragically, you know, torn apart.
It's definitely a region where like family, you know, family is incredibly important, perhaps, you know, in some countries that we're more familiar with, that's the family unit. It's important, but it's not like above all else. Whereas certainly, that's what we've seen. Even films like About Earlier, Women Without Men. It's just like, you know, the first, you must honor your family. Don't, you know, if you do something wrong, that's going to reflect badly on your brother, for example, as a woman. And yeah, this does also hone on the theme that like, yeah, it is, the family is so incredibly important.
Yeah, and like, and what even is, I suppose, family in a broader sense in a lot of these contexts is like something that I think a lot of these films explore. Is like this idea of, you know, you do still, you know, there's this sense of honor or solidarity with someone of the same country or someone of the same community is something that's very often, it's often very tense. And the consequences of a relationship that is too tense can lead to some pretty destructive ends. But yeah, there is still that sort of perpetual value of family, even if it can, you know, often end in something that's, you know, a pretty tragic outcome. But we don't want to finish on too somber a note. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us here on Sacred Cinema on 2XXFM. It's been an absolute pleasure having you. Good luck with
thanks
everything. Good luck with, yeah, no worries. It's been fantastic getting your knowledge of the region, everything like that. We'd love to have you again, and all the best in the future.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for Sacred Cinema this week. Thanks again to Sarah Barry, a good friend of mine from my old ANU days. Thanks so much for joining us, Sarah. And to you, the listener, thanks so much for listening. Please stay tuned to 2XX for more quality radio programming coming right up here on 2XX. Or jump into our website, listen to the show on demand, subscribe, sponsor, all those things would be very much appreciated. Until next week, have a good week. See ya.